Hello, welcome to New Books in Buddhist Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm Luke Thompson, the host of the channel. Today I'll be speaking with Clark Chilson about his new book, Secrecy's Power, Covert Shin Buddhists in Japan and Contradictions of Concealment, published by the University of Hawaii Press in 2014 as part of the Nanzan Library of Asian Religion and Culture series. This book examines secret groups of Shin practitioners, that is, true Pure Land Buddhist practitioners, from the 13th century onward, but focuses primarily on the past 150 years. Although today at least 30 different lineages of secret Shin continue to operate, with a total estimated membership numbering in the tens of thousands, because they have been so successful at hiding, a technique they have perfected over a period of centuries, few scholars are even aware of their existence. Based on extensive ethnographic fieldwork that he conducted from 1998 onward, and a number of reports written by mainstream Shin monks who infiltrated these groups or researchers who befriended them, Chilson explains why certain groups concealed their doctrines and practices and even existence, and, more importantly, reveals the long-term consequences that secrecy had on these groups. In addition, Chilson provides an in-depth theoretical introduction showing that scholarship on secrecy has too often conflated different types of secrecy, for example, esotericism and social secrecy. This is a problem that is particularly vexing in the case of Japanese religion, in which the influence of esoteric Buddhism is so pervasive. Rather than simply confining such theoretical concerns to the introduction and conclusion, Chilson skillfully weaves issues related to concealment into the fabric of each chapter, explaining how the case studies he presents illustrate this or that function or consequence of secrecy. Chilson distinguishes between two types of covert Shin groups, those that went into hiding due to persecution, and those in which secrecy was an integral element from their very genesis, and he outlines the similarities and differences between the two. While much scholarship on secrecy and religion has focused on why groups have secrets in the first place, for example, to avoid persecution, and on secrecy's personal power, for example, personal authority or the power to avoid detection, Chilson draws our attention instead to how concealment influences the structure, doctrines, and practices of these groups, and to the way in which secrecy, at first a consciously wielded instrument, is eventually incorporated so thoroughly into a tradition that its power becomes structural, a force controlled by no single person, but which pervades the group and becomes central to its identity. In this way, Chilson answers the question that many readers will want to ask. Why did the practice of secrecy continue in persecuted groups once the threat of persecution had subsided? On a fascinating journey that takes us from Shinran's 13th century admonition of his eldest son for claiming to possess secret teachings, to a 21st century covert Shin leader who worries about the dwindling number of adherents, we hear of secret caves in southern Kyushu used for clandestine worship, dietary proscriptions of chicken and milk, punishment of covert Shin members in northeastern Japan, ranging from promises to abandon covert Shin to crucifixion, and a covert Shin group whose members associated them with the Kuya-do and became ordained Tendai priests in order to deflect suspicion. In addition, through access to groups that few scholars have been granted, Chilson describes in detail many of the initiation rituals and teachings at the center of certain covert Shin groups, all the while addressing the ethical dilemmas that researchers studying secret groups face. This book will be of particular interest to those researching or interested in Jodo Shinshu, that is, Japanese Pure Land Buddhism, secrecy in religion, secret societies, Edo period regulation of religious groups, modern Japanese religion, and religious identity. I hope you enjoy the interview. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to New Books in Buddhist Studies. I'm Luke Thompson, the host of the channel. Today I'm with Clark Chilson, and we're going to be talking about his new book, Secrecy's Power, Covert Shin Buddhists in Japan and Contradictions of Concealment, published by the University of Hawaii Press in 2014. Clark Chilson is associate professor in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pittsburgh, where he is also a faculty member of the Japan Studies Program and Asian Studies Center of the University Center for International Studies. Clark Chilson, welcome to the show, and thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak about my book. I appreciate it.
No, pleasure's mine. So I was wondering if you could begin the interview by just telling us a bit about yourself, where you're from, how you came to the study of Japan or Japanese Buddhism and religion,
and if you might mention any important influences in your life, academic advisors or whatnot.
Okay. Sure. I was born and raised in Rochester, New York. And I suppose that, you know, I had a very early introduction to the study of religion through my mother, who was very religious until I was about age 11. And as she was the person who raised me and took me to church twice a week, I suppose my real interest in religion started very, very young. And, you know, she was very adamant about having me learn the Bible, and by the time I was 11 years old, I had memorized many, many hundreds of verses of the Bible. And I remember winning an award about age 11 for memorizing over 400 verses of the Bible, mostly the New Testament.
Wow.
So, you know, what my mother taught me through that was, you know, really that there was this other language and other ways of thinking about the world that were both grounded in history of the past and, you know, could be applied to the present. And so, although my mother moved away from the church, particularly as the evangelical fundamentalist churches became much more conservative and right-wing in their politics, my mother was rather progressive. You know, I think that what she taught me, which was always important and still, you know, resonates with me, is how religion can act as a resource in people's lives. So, and, you know, I much of my relationship with religion is really this relationship of embrace and then leaving and then coming back to. So in my early life, I, you know, was very much involved in, you know, religious practice and ritual and memorizing scripture. And then in my teenage years, you know, was very, had no religion in my life. We never, you know, did anything religious. And, you know, I really engaged in those things teenage boys like to engage in, sports, sensual pleasures. But the question, you know, never left me, which was, how does one live one's life? And at age 18, after being in university for a year at Buffalo State College, I had the opportunity to go to Japan as an exchange student. I had no real interest in Japan, but, you know, it was away from Buffalo. It could get me out of the U.S. And I had the very good fortune of having Ian Reeder, who is this very prominent scholar of contemporary Japanese religion today. But at that time, this was around 1987, at that time, he was only one or two, maybe 3 years from his PhD, and his career was just about to take off. And he was an instructor at Kansai Gaidai, where I was an exchange student. And what he taught me that was, you know, was how you can engage and study religion without actually having a religious commitment to what you were studying. And, you know, this was eye-opening for me that, you know, here was this subject of study in which, you know, you could engage with it and find things interesting, but didn't have to necessarily practice or believe it. And and Ian, I don't know if you've ever had a chance to meet him, Luke.
Once in the UCABS conference long ago, but
yeah. Well, he is a, those who have a chance to meet him rarely forget him because he's a very different type of academic. He he lectures with no socks on, and and you know, when everyone else is wearing a tie, he's wearing a t-shirt. So he kind of, you know, struck me. He had this very important influence of, you know, you could really study religion in a different way. And so that's when I was 19, and then I decided to stay in Japan and actually did my undergraduate work at Nanzan University in anthropology. And there I studied mostly with a man from Switzerland, a professor by the name of Peter Canet, who was who is a Catholic priest and also someone who has a very encyclopedic knowledge about Japan and Japanese folk religion. And what he taught me, again, was another way of thinking about how we can engage with the study of religion, which is, here was a man who was a Catholic priest, who was very committed to the Catholic Church, yet he could study Japanese folk Buddhism, in a way that was, again, revealing and not based on a religious commitment. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think that those three different very important people in my life showed me that there's these different ways to engage with the study of religion, and each of them can be nourishing and revealing in their own way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when I went to Japan and I was living in Japan, I think the other thing that really made me interested in Buddhism was this disconnect between the way Buddhism is often talked about in the English language media in North America as being about meditation and mm-hmm. more recently mindfulness. And then you go to Japan or pretty much anywhere else in East Asia and you find that, you know, most people don't meditate, that, you know, Buddhism is really more about this worldly problems and people are more interested in ritual than doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, the humanness of the Buddhism in Japan, where its interest in very earthy things, it really fascinated me and was mm-hmm. much more interesting to me than the intellectualized Buddhism that we often find in the popular mm-hmm. press.
Right.
So,
I see. So, I see. So going on from that, how did you come to focus specifically on covert shin? You mentioned in the book that your initial intention was to study Kuya, the 10th century sort of wandering holy man who actually adorns the cover of your book. So how did the shift occur? Or how did you come to focus on covert shin? And did your, and for listeners who haven't read the book, I should mention on the one hand, covert shin is the focus of the book, but also secrecy. The topic of secrecy is the theme that runs throughout and the one that you explore in great depth throughout the book. So was your, did your interest in secrecy in religion precede your interest in covert shin, or was your focus on the issue of secrecy a natural result of studying covert shin?
So, yes, as you mentioned, I was initially interested in doing history of Buddhism, particularly history of folk Buddhism in Japan. And I had written, you know, my MA thesis on a biography of Kuya.
Mm.
And, you know, going back to this theme of, you know, embracing leaving and coming back in a different way, you know, after I left Kansai Gaidai, you know, I had I studied religion, anthropological studies of religion at Nanzan, and then I went to the UK and studied with Michael Pye at Lancaster University.
Mm.
And then Ian Reeder had also returned to the UK, and so I started actually doing my PhD under his guidance.
Mm.
So my first instructor in Japanese religion and my last in a formal context was Ian Reeder.
Mm.
And Ian was very, you know, interested in contemporary things,
mm-hmm.
and you know his influence, you know, on me was really profound, and so when I was working on Kuya, I was looking at Kuya both in the historical and contemporary context, and stumbled across a group of people who had a relationship with Kuya that, you know, I wasn't quite sure of.
Mm-hmm.
So there's these statues of Kuya, one of which is on the cover of the book,
mm-hmm.
in which Kuya has these images of little men-like figures coming out of his mouth, and they're little bodhisattvas, each representing one of the syllables of the Nembutsu. So mm-hmm. Namu Amida Butsu. So there's the six there.
Mm.
And art historians have taken a real interest in these, and so they've documented where each one of these are.
Mm.
And these people told me that they had a similar image in an area of the country where no art historian had mentioned there being one.
Mm.
And so I was very eager to see it. I thought I'd made a real discovery for art historians. But they were not too eager to show it to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found this odd that, you know, here were these people who were interested in Kuya. They were at this Kuya Memorial Service in mm-hmm. Kyoto, where I met them. They live nowhere near Kyoto. And I asked them to visit, and they said, basically they said no, and I kept asking in kind of a slightly aggressive, slightly obsequious way. And eventually they had a group of older men had a conversation, and one of the men gave me a phone number and some very basic directions and said, call and we'll set up a time.
Mm-hmm.
So I called and they gave me a time and a place where I could go see them. And when I got there, I was basically interviewed by them, my interests. And I said my interests were in Kuya, and I was very interested in their place here because they had this Kuya statue. And the elder man, who was introduced as the Zenchiski, or the leader of the group, he said, well, you know, Kuya is important, but we're really interested in Shin, you know, this Pure Land Buddhism, mm-hmm. Shin Pure Land Buddhism of Shinran. And I thought, oh, so I told him a little bit about what I knew about, you know, Shin Pure Land Buddhism. And he said, yes, but we're most interested in the real Shin Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And that began a conversation which gradually leaked out that, you know, they felt that there was this Shin tradition, and they believed in the Shin tradition, and they practiced the Shin tradition, which they said was handed down in secret from the founder of Shin Buddhism, Shinran.
Mm-hmm.
And this really fascinated me because I had never heard of these people.
Mm.
And when I did a little investigation, everything pointed to that, yes, at one time in the 18th century, they were quite active, but they didn't survive mm-hmm. into the modern period.
Yes.
So lastly, before I really started to study the covert Shin Buddhists, I had been at a Buddhist studies conference, and I mentioned to a prominent scholar of contemporary Buddhism in Japan, or modern Buddhism in Japan, Hayashi Makoto, and he said, Clark, if you came across these people, you need to study them because there's, you know, this would be quite a find.
Yeah.
And then Peter Kinnett, who I also consulted, you know, he had pointed me to the direction of similar types of groups that were active in the Tohoku region, which were still secretive, that some people had published on. So
right.
It was really this rare opportunity to study a secret group who I'd come across totally by accident,
right,
and who seemed to be willing to talk with me.
Mm, I see. So in the preface, you describe before we get on to the actual covert Shin groups themselves. In the preface, you describe a shift in your approach to the topic of covert Shin and the issue of secrecy, whereby you stopped focusing exclusively on why certain practices were secret or why certain groups operated in secret, and turn your attention instead to consequences. That is, what are the results of having secret practices and operating secretly, or what are the consequences and functions of secrecy, rather than why does secrecy occur in the first place? So what you find is that first, secrecy separates, creating both social and conceptual distance, and second, that secrecy has many unintended consequences, both positive and negative, for the people being secretive, or the people doing the concealing. So I was just wondering if you could mention how the shift came about. Was this through reading scholarship on secrecy and religion outside of Japan, or through a realization that the question of secrecy's origins wasn't as important or interesting?
Well, it came about really through my engagement with, you know, doing field work with people, with covert Shin Buddhists. And I started out looking at, you know, why they were secretive, you know, why hide your religion?
Yeah.
Because they weren't just esoteric. They were actually concealing their very existence from the public. They didn't want the public to know they existed. They didn't want the public to know where they met. They didn't want the public to know what their rituals were or who they were. And so I was curious in the beginning as to, you know, why they would want to do this at a time when they were not in danger of persecution. It was freedom of religion in Japan. And so why remain secret? And so, you know, during my doctoral dissertation, I focused primarily on that and some of the benefits that they got from secrecy throughout time and continued today.
Right.
Then, you know, I felt at some point in my field work that I needed to to be a little bit more upfront with the people I was doing fieldwork with. Mm-hmm. They had invited me to become initiated, and I declined for some ethical reasons. I didn't think it would be right.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I was reading and finding these historical documents about things that they were saying, and I was finding, you know, very minor publications done in-house by Shin Buddhist priests that were basically revealing, you know, a lot of the secrets that they had discovered through covert action of their own. They infiltrated these groups.
These are Shin Pure Land priests from the sort of mainstream Shin Buddhist institutions.
Correct. Right. That regard these covert Shin Buddhists as heretics, and so they would go in and you know, either find some connection or try to find some connection through their temples and then expose them.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly early 20th century when they were growing fairly rapidly for a short period.
I see.
So the long and the short of it is I actually knew more of their secrets than they were actually telling me.
I see.
but they kept saying, you know, this is, you know, all this, no one knows about this, no one knows about that. And I was happy to go along with, you know, letting them believe that for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually I felt I need to show them some of the things that I had found to let them know, you know, actually what I knew.
Right.
And so when I showed the leader this, he was quite disturbed at first. You know, he said, oh, this should never happen. He had heard that these kind of things had happened, but he never actually had seen it.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, we're told we should, you know, slit our stomachs before revealing this type of thing. And, but after a while, you know, it wasn't that long, maybe a half hour or so, he had kind of digested what, you know, I just showed him, and, you know, and he pointed out that, you know, this wasn't actually right, that there was a number of errors in some of the things that I was showing him. And, and you know, he was less disturbed about it than I thought. So that made me think, okay, well, why does the publication of some of these secrets not make that much difference to him? Why didn't it scandalize him more?
Right.
And to answer that question, I really needed to think about, you know, well, what does secrecy do? What does it do for them? What does it do to them?
Yeah.
And so that got me thinking about the consequences of secrecy. And what I discovered that I think is important is that secrecy has multiple consequences and that these consequences actually conflict with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, six of these consequences that I deal with in the book most extensively that contradict each other or conflict with each other are the consequence of persecution versus the consequence of protection.
Yeah.
And the consequence of, you know, helping secrecy helps preserve a tradition, but it also leads to its transformation.
Yeah.
Secrecy creates dilemmas, which make it difficult to know what to do, but then it also gives order, which makes it very clear about what one should do. And so when I started to see these consequences and how they were opposed to each other and how covert organizations really had to negotiate these consequences, then secrecy became much more interesting for me because it wasn't just secrecy. People are secretive because of X, or people are secretive because of X, Y, and Z.
Right.
Typically, when you read about secrecy, you read that, oh, people are secretive because they're hiding something they don't want the public to know that's nefarious or bad.
Right.
Or they're hiding because they're trying to get authority to themselves and just trying to lure people in.
Right.
And so typically when you read about secrecy, it's that secrecy does something for these people, and that's why they're secret.
Yeah.
And what I found is that actually secrecy does a number of things both for and to secretive groups. And to understand secrecy's power and to understand secretive organizations, we really have to look at how those consequences come about and how they are negotiated in differently in different social contexts.
Yeah. So this sort of links to this connects to association distinction you make in the introduction between secrecy's personal power and secrecy's sort of impersonal or structural power. And you note that scholarship on secrecy has often focused primarily on the personal power that could be created through secrecy. You just mentioned it sort of does something for a person.
Correct. Yeah.
Moving on a little bit, just you in the introduction, you set this, you kind of set the theoretical framework for the book, the theoretical framework in which you want readers to understand covert Shin, and you have this kind of set up a loose dichotomy between the mainstream Shin Buddhism, what you call overt Shin for the purposes of the book, and a number of secret Shin groups that try to hide their very existence, what you call covert Shin. Mm. So now, besides this distinction between personal power and sort of structural power, you also make a distinction between esoteric and social secrecy, two categories that are separate, but that in actual practice often are often found together. And I wanted you just to mention what this distinction is, because I think it's particularly important in this case, because I think a lot of people, when they think about secrecy in Japanese religion, and particularly Buddhism, they'll immediately think about esoteric Buddhism.
Right. So one of the things I learned from doing this research and giving presentations on it before I wrote the book was how confusing the word secrecy can actually be.
Mm.
When I talk about secrecy, I'm typically talking about social secrecy, but much of my audience, because I'm speaking about secrecy in Buddhism, would assume that I would somehow be talking about esotericism and trying to connect this with esoteric Buddhism and the different strains of esoteric Buddhism. So what I really tried to do in the introduction, one of the two things I really tried to do in the introductory chapter was to explain that there's these different basic types of secrecy in religion, and that we really need to be clear what type of secrecy we're talking about when we talk about secrecy in religion, because if these types of secrecy are confused, then this will result in poor comparative work and theoretical confusion.
Mm-hmm.
So I point out in the introduction that there's three types, basic types of secrecy that we find in religion. One is mystery, in which, you know, the divine keeps secrets that is not revealed except through mystical experience. And then we have esoteric secrecy, which, like mystery, is also hidden by the divine, or something that, if not the divine, then some ultimate truth that transcends the social world. So the truth that esoteric secrets purport to hold is not contingent upon the social world. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's an ultimate truth that would transcend history. But this true is typically hid by something beyond just the social world.
Yeah.
But it can be discovered if one gets the proper training, either through ritual or through certain hermeneutical training.
Yeah.
Where social secrecy, what is being hidden is not some ultimate truth, but these are conventional things.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the divine or something that transcends the social world is not hiding it from people the way it would be in mystery and esotericism.
Mm-hmm.
But social secrecy is really when people hide things from other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we talk about secrecy in religion, we need to be clear what type of secrecy we're talking about. Otherwise, we can confuse the categories and this can have bad consequences.
Right.
So I try to give the example, the analogy of love as being similar, where, you know, people talk about they love something or someone. So I love my wife, I love my husband, I love my children, I love baseball.
Uh-huh.
And if we treat all these types of love as if they were the same thing, this would create confusion, as it,
right.
I think it does in English. So just like there's the agape type of love, which is a non-erotic, self-giving type of love, and then you have the eros, which is a different type of more romantic love.
Right.
we want to make sure we don't confuse those categories when we're talking about love. And when we're talking about secrecy, we also don't want to confuse categories because mm-hmm. this can cause confusion.
Yeah. So to give an example, like the esoteric, you know, you could take a scripture like the Lotus Sutra, and there's no social secrecy there because it's not hidden from anyone, but there's an esoteric secrecy. There can be in certain interpretations, there could be an esoteric secrecy, which is the sort of hidden meaning behind what one sort of reads on the surface.
Correct. And I think it becomes a little bit confusing in the history of Japanese Buddhism because you often see esotericism and social secrecy overlapping.
Right. Okay.
In that you have a text that will give the esoteric real meaning of, for example, the Lotus Sutra.
Mm-hmm.
It will reveal the real meaning of the Lotus Sutra, the ultimate meaning of the Lotus Sutra. And then that text, which is a text that gives this interpretation, this esoteric interpretation, that text is hidden by people from other people. So then you have, you know, the text being part of social secrecy.
Right.
But the content of the text itself is really about esoteric secrets.
Yeah.
So when we look at the history of Japanese Buddhism, where this was quite common, where social secrecy would be used to hide certain esoteric doctrines, certain esoteric texts, certain esoteric rituals, it's really important to distinguish, you know, when is there social secrecy going on and when is there and how is that distinctive from the esoteric secrecy, so we can understand how the two relate to each other
right.
better. Yeah.
Excuse me. So so moving on, you note that we know of at least 30 covert Shin Pure Land Buddhist groups, but that they're generally sort of divided into these three groups. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but there's the sort of northeastern Japan, the Tohoku group, the southern Kyushu group, and then another group that's sort of throughout central Japan, but which is generally traced back to medieval Shin groups that were thought to be heretical at the time.
Correct. That's how Honganji, or the main mainstream Shin Buddhist institutions, that's how they have divided up covert Shin Buddhists.
Yeah. And then in this book specifically, you explicitly discuss three groups: the Gonaiho group in the northeast, specifically after the mid 19th century; the Kirishimako group in southern Kyushu from I think the mid 17th or century on, and then the Urahomon in central Japan, which is you discuss the most, and which is the least known in the secondary sources that do exist. So moving on into chapter one, you provide a reader with an overview of secrecy in Shin Buddhism, noting that overt Shin has generally insisted that there are no secret teachings in Shin, and Shinran in the 13th century and Renyo in the 15th century said as much. And it seems their statements to this effect have been cited as a scriptural basis by Shin clerics who have spoken out against covert Shin. But Yu's want to argue that although this may be true, secrecy does in fact have a place within certain Shin traditions. And in this chapter, you give examples in which secrecy led to criticism and persecution, while in the following chapter, you give an example in which secrecy protected but also transformed traditions. So these are some of the unintended consequences that you're talking about. So would you just start us off here by describing attitudes towards secrecy in medieval Japan and in the Edo period, noting how these attitudes affected and shaped covert Shin? And for listeners not familiar with Japanese periodization, Edo period is roughly 1600, 1603 to 1868.
So first, you know, let me clarify, you know, the types of covert Shin. I think it's simpler if we look at two types of covert Shin, and that is one type which secrecy is intrinsic to the group from its origins. They believe that Shinran from the 13th century had given a secret tradition, and that they are the holders and preservers and transmitters of that teaching. Mm-hmm. So that's one type that has the intrinsic secrecy. And then you have the groups in southern Kyushu, which became secret as a response to persecution.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's probably a simpler way to try to divide them up.
Right.
And in the first chapter, I'm looking primarily at the history of these groups that claim to have a secret tradition that was given to them by Shinran and passed on through generations among the laity.
Mm-hmm.
So the attitudes toward secrecy in Japan has changed very much from medieval period to the early modern period. So in the 13th, 14th, and 15th century, secrecy was very common amongst almost all religious organizations, Buddhist organization. Buddhist lineages very much often split themselves up based on, you know, their different secretive traditions, and having something revealed in secrecy was very common. And, you know, different lineages of, you know, the performing arts or the visual arts, they would also have their secret traditions, and these were passed on from master to disciple. So secrecy was considered to be very important in medieval Japan for having authority, and that it was really, you know, the master giving secrets to the disciple that legitimated who they were and their ability to practice and teach and to transmit.
Mm-hmm.
In the 16th and 17th century, when Confucianism becomes prominent and a prominent ideology, secrecy is really held in question. And so we find that the type of authority that could be gotten from secrecy in the medieval period is not the case when we get into the 17th, 18th century. So the attitudes amongst, you know, Shin Buddhists was towards secrecy was slightly different in that it didn't use secrecy the way most social organizations did in the medieval period to give legitimation and authority. But until the time of the 15th century, until Renyo, who was a major Shin leader, until that time, you know, they weren't that concerned with secretive organizations. They saw them as heretical, but they weren't really interested in too much persecution of them. But in the 15th century, Renyo becomes very concerned that they're spreading heresy, and he has these dramatic statements, some of which I've included in the book, in which he says anybody who accepts these secret teachings will go to hell. And so the attitudes towards secrecy in Shin has been pretty negative for a long time, and certainly much longer than it's been in other Buddhist traditions. But in the Edo period, when the attitudes towards secrecy were very negative, wide across the board, then there was much more severe persecution of Shin Buddhists. So now you actually got the government involved. You have Shin priests getting the government involved, trying to find out who these people are, trying to find out where they meet, trying to find out what they do, exposing them, punishing them through sending them into exile, leaders in exile, and in some cases even having them executed. So we really see that their secrecy during their history was not doing much for them, because it led to this persecution, and this persecution became particularly heavy in the 18th and 19th century. So yeah. This is, I think, an important point to remember when we think about secrecy, is that it often does lead to persecution because people think there's something improper. And I think this is very much alive and well today in North America. You know, if you have to hide it, then there must be something wrong.
Sure. Right.
So
the sort of the secrecy and the relative orthodoxy or heterodoxy of a particular group are in a sense two separate issues, but I suppose when a group is secrecy, the assumption in Edo period Japan, at least, is that they're sort of doing something that's either religiously heterodox or or something that's politically subversive, I suppose.
Yes. I mean, the very idea that you would have a secret is from the 17th century on becomes one that's very suspect.
Right.
And continues today. So, you know, they were not secretive because they were persecuted. They were persecuted because they were secretive.
Yeah, right.
And
so, right. So which, well, that actually leads us to this, the group you focus on in chapter two, actually, which is a group in southern Kyushu, the Kirishimako, which was active from the early or the mid 17th century. And you note that this group faced intense hostility as the Shimizu, the ruling family of Satsuma, had persecuted Shin Buddhism from at least the late 15th century. So could you just first tell listeners, I mean, who were the Kirishimako?
Okay. So let me give a little background to explain the Kirishimako that is surprisingly unknown even amongst experts on Japan. And that is, in the Satsuma Han, which was one of the largest, most powerful feudal domains in Japan during the Edo period, so from the, you know, particularly during the 17th, 18th, 19th century, they did not allow anyone to be a Shin Pure Land Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
They had actually prohibited and banned Shin Buddhism, and if you were caught to be a Shin Buddhist, you would be punished sometimes very severely. So, like the secretive Christians, Christianity was also banned during this time throughout Japan. Those who remained in the tradition went underground. They had to hide their tradition to avoid punishment.
Mm-hmm.
So different than the groups, you know, the groups we discussed in the first chapter, which were, you know, secretive and then persecuted.
Right.
These were groups that were perfectly fine, but then had to become secretive to avoid persecution. And so tiny groups of people continue to practice Shin Buddhism, a very orthodox type of Shin Buddhism in the beginning, at least. In secrecy, so they would not be persecuted, and they, you know, they would meet in caves, and we actually have in southern Kyushu today, historians have preserved some of the caves in which they met. They actually went underground, literally. They dug holes in the side of hills or in the ground, and they would create chambers underground in which they would go into and have their worship ceremonies. Or they would go out in boats and have them. And so there was lots of these different little groups in hiding. And, you know, some of them probably died out and some of them survived. And one of them that survived was a group called the Kirishimako. And so they apparently started out as a rather typical group of Shin Buddhists. And we know this because of, you know, their mythology makes Amida Buddha central. They read Shinran and Nenyu as scripture. Those are central scriptures to them. They celebrate the death dates of Shinran and Nenyu. So we see that, you know, that there's central Shin elements here, but to hide their practice of Shin Buddhism, they affiliated themselves with a mountain in the area called Kirishima, which was very famous as a holy place and typically connected with Shinto, not Buddhism. So they presented themselves as a lay organization that were devotees of Kirishima, Shinto. And they use this to hide their Pure Land practices.
I should mention here that for people who listeners who don't have the book yet, you have some very nice pictures in here of some of the Well, you have one of the caves that covert Shin Buddhists built, and also some of the hollowed out pillars that were used to hide icons, and
right.
also one of the stones that was used to torture covert Shin adherents if they were found.
Right.
So, picking up on where you left off, so in this case, they sort of associate themselves with the mountain Kirishima, with Mount Kirishima, and the sort of Kirishima Shinto in order to so it starts out as what you call dissimulation.
Right.
But you argue that, in fact, this incorporation, although it started off as a sort of conscious strategy to evade detection, to avoid detection, that eventually it becomes integrated into the group's identity.
Correct.
Okay. So,
this might be a good time to explain a little bit about personal power and structural power, because I think
sure.
what you just delineated there is helpful for trying to understand what the two are and how they relate to each other.
Sure.
So, you know, personal power is really about getting power to get people to do things in a particular way.
Mm.
So, you know, you can get them to do something for you, or you can control their perceptions, or control how they think of you, or control what they do for you. And so secrecy in this particular case with the Kirishima Ko, it has this personal power in the sense that, you know, it controls the way other people perceive who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're actively using it for their own personal gain, for the gain of their own organization, that they won't be persecuted.
Mm-hmm.
But it also comes to take on structural power, and this is the power that is not limited to any particular person. Mm-hmm. This is power that would transcend any person or group of people, and it's the power that we find of tradition, of linguistic conventions,
mm-hmm.
In which, you know, these are things that influence the way people act and behave, but yet no one actually controls them or sets them into place.
Mm-hmm.
And so secrecy has structural power once it becomes very much part of an organization.
Mm-hmm.
And so in Kirishima Ko, you know, secrecy becomes part of their identity, and it is, you know, by the 19th century, it is being referred to as sacred, and therefore any revealing of secrets to outsiders becomes a grave taboo,
mm.
which, you know, they said would lead to rebirth in hell.
Mm.
So it becomes, yes, it becomes part of their identity, and when it becomes part of their identity, then it really takes on not just a personal power, but then it takes on a structural power.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because secrecy has structural power that it's really hard to negotiate some of the conflicting consequences of secrecy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, people say, well, if they're persecuted because they're secretive, why don't they just come out and stop being secretive? Why don't they just be open?
Right.
I mean, this would solve their problem, wouldn't it?
Right.
And then the response is, well, there's this, you know, once it becomes part of who they are,
right.
once it becomes a method for giving structure to the religion, you can't just, there's no way you can, by coming out in the open, would is really an option without radically changing the religion as a whole.
Right. Yeah. Which wouldn't have been true in the very beginning if they'd only been secret for a very short while.
Correct. With the Kirishima Ko, yes. With any group that goes into hiding to protect themselves.
Right,
yes.
Right. Okay, so the chapter one and chapter two constitute the first part of the book, and the second part of the book, comprising chapters 3, 4, and 5, focuses on the Udahomon, which is the group with which you have had the most contact and which constitutes the central case study of the book, in a sense. And you also note that this is the group that's been most neglected in secondary scholarship, though, of course, there's not much secondary scholarship anyway on any of the
right.
covert Shin
right.
groups. Could you just maybe just very briefly mention what or who the Udahomon are?
Okay. So Udahomon are one lineage of which there's probably, you know, at least several and maybe dozens of lineages in central Japan.
Mm.
There's at least 30 lineages throughout Japan that we know that are covert Shin Buddhists of the intrinsic secrecy type.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of those lineages in central Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And they call themselves Udahomon because they believe that they carry on a secretive ultimate teaching of Shinran.
Mm-hmm.
The term Uda in Japanese would mean the backside of something or something that is undercover. So something not seen would be Uda.
Mm.
And Udahomon would be the secret teaching. So the homon could be the Dharma or the homon being, you know, the Dharma or teachings, and Uda being secret. So this is a name that they sometimes refer to themselves as.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're a lineage made up of today, you know, I'm going to say about 7 or 8 major leaders who each have groups that they lead. Typically they'll meet, you know, today they might meet in groups of 20 to 40 at people's homes, mm. often at the leaders' homes,
mm-hmm.
or somewhere else hidden from the public. And many of the men who are the leaders of these groups are wealthy, so they are able to support them, live in nice-sized houses, which allow for these types of meetings.
Mm. Okay, so in these three chapters on Udahomon, in the first chapter, chapter 3, you basically this goes back to the introduction in which you identify three strategies often used by covert groups to hide, which you identify as limiting visibility, dissimulation, and then just silence, complete silence. And
right.
In chapter 3, you discuss one particular branch of the Udahomon's, one particular branch's use of dissimulation. So could you just say what dissimulation is and why this particular, the founder of this branch, a man named Ono, turned to dissimulation in this case and what that entailed?
Sure. So by dissimulation, what I mean is when someone pretends to be something that they actually do not primarily identify with.
So like the Kirishima-ko with the Kirishima Mountain Shinto.
Exactly. Right. So in other words, they don't, you know, when they meet together, they may see themselves as being Shin Buddhist, but when they're out in public, they would present themselves as Kirishima-ko.
Yeah.
And you
also mentioned the like the crypto Jews and crypto Muslims in 16th century Spain as examples.
Yeah, they also do this. You know, so you know they might go to, you know, crypto Jews might go to a might have went to a Catholic church and lit candles on Sabbath, and
mm-hmm.
You know, even in certain cases, even would keep pigs as a way of indicating we really aren't Jewish.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, this is, and you know, the secretive Christians did this in Japan as well. So this is a fairly common strategy mm-hmm. that covert organizations use. I mean, for example, in the CIA, you know, reporters, for example, are often, you know, people who are actually working for the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why, you know, when reporters are arrested somewhere, you know, the intelligence community typically denies that they're
right.
working for the CIA. But so they're, you know, you're, basically it's presenting yourself as something that you're really not.
Yeah.
And so the case of Udahomon, Ono, the leader in the late 19th, early 20th century, he had a problem. And that problem was, you know, he was getting a lot of people who were interested in what he was saying. And so he had a lot of people appearing at his home. And this looked quite strange to the neighbors and the local law enforcement.
Mm.
And he had decided that he needed to connect himself with some religious institution. And the oral tradition is, I've never been able to find documentary proof of this, but the oral tradition is that he went to a number of different places asking for affiliation, and they all wanted him to go through certain types of training, which he didn't want to go through, until he came to this rather unusual temple called the Kuyado in Kyoto, which had a very small lineage in the Edo period. It was related to both to the imperial family and to outcast groups. And when he approached them, they were receptive. And we do have documentation of their giving him a religious affiliation in the late 1880s. So basically, he then started to present his organization as a lay group that was devoted to Kuya and that was part of the Kuya-do lineage. And so this, you know, kept him and his disciples from being investigated for what they were really doing. And central to the Shin Buddhist tradition is the recitation of Amida's name, so the Nembutsu. And this was also very central to the Kuya-do. So it wasn't a big leap. And, you know, that relationship has been strained over the past 100 years. It's very strained today. You know, but it continues among certain groups. You know, the current priest of the Kuya-do, I don't know how much he knows about these people. He's currently a professor at Kyoto University in agriculture. But yeah, the relationship is not what it was 50, right. 60 years ago.
So basically, the Ono branch of the Urahomon covert Shin Buddhists, when people become leaders or Zenshi Shiki within that branch, they actually go, they technically become priests of the Kuya-do. So technically, they're Tendai priests.
Yes.
Even though, for all practical purposes, they don't incorporate Tendai ritual or doctrine explicitly into their tradition.
Correct. Yes. So, yeah. I mean, they very clearly say, you know, this, we do this for the omote. We do this as a facade. You know, and you know, there's advantages for doing it. You know, when they bought property, in one case they bought a property in which they built something. And they were able to buy that property without having to pay taxes for it. So there's certain advantages that they get from being affiliated with the Kuya-do that they want to maintain even today.
So we're getting closer to the end, but I did want you I wanted to ask if you could just address the dilemma that you talk about in chapter 4, one of the dilemmas that results from secrecy, namely when to reveal, when to conceal. And you mentioned two situations in which this dilemma arises for the Urahomon, in proselytizing and
cases of persecution.
And cases of persecution, right,
yeah.
Where they're being sort of misrepresented in the media or by other groups. Could you just mention sort of these two dilemmas and how Urahomon has gone about dealing with these dilemmas that are basically the result of being secretive?
Right. So covert organizations that want to persist over time, as covert religious organizations do, they face an inherent dilemma, which is, you know, to tell a secret, the secret would no longer be a secret if it's revealed. But if you don't tell the secret, if you don't reveal the secret, then the secret will die. So, which would go against the desire to keep the secret alive. So you have this tension between revealing and concealing, which needs to be negotiated. And this is important when you're proselytizing to new people. So typically the way covert secretive religions do this is they pass it on from generation to generation, and this is pretty safe because it's in the family and people are considered less likely to betray family.
Right.
But when you go outside the, you know, kinship relationships and you proselytize to friends and neighbors, which does happen in Udohomon, then you really have to be careful. So the dilemma is, you know, how can you reveal? And typically I think the answer is that, you know, you need to have a balance between revealing and concealing. And what I found is that it's not a balance. What happens is all the authority is given to one person mm-hmm. about who can reveal and conceal, who can reveal. Mm. And that's how they attempt to solve this dilemma, is by saying nobody can reveal or proselytize and tell the secrets except for the leader.
Yeah.
You can bring people to the leader, but he's the only one that can do it. And so that's how they try to deal with that dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
And then in cases of persecution, again, you know, they could be persecuted. Like after the Ohm incident,
right.
You know, are they doing something that's going to be dangerous to society? And, you know, so you had police getting really interested in marginal religious activities and so really scrutinizing yeah. local villages. And so at that time, some groups came out and said, listen, you know, this is what we're doing to a certain degree.
But, sorry to interrupt. I should, if for listeners who aren't familiar with the Ohm affair that you refer to as the 1995 sarin gas attacks on the Tokyo subways by a new religious group called Om Shinrikyo, I think.
Yes.
And,
yes.
Right. And in fact, 2 years ago, there was that special issue of the Japanese Journal of Religious Studies that sort of focused on the way that the Om affairs affected new religions. Well, not just new religions, but I guess mainly new religions and secretive religions in Japan.
Right, right.
But you mentioned in the case of Udohomon, a lot of, even after the Ohm affair, a lot of groups have sort of continued to, it hasn't affected them too adversely, it sounds like.
No, I mean, I think that in some cases, the leaders decided not to say anything. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, some leaders went to the police and gave a little bit of description of what they were doing.
Yeah.
But the long and the short of it is that no, it didn't make a huge difference, and I think in part because the as many secretive organizations, the covert Shin Buddhists are very much cell organizations, which means they're very small, pocketed organizations which don't have networks which they're involved with beyond themselves,
mm-hmm.
and so when you're talking about very small groups, and particularly of older people, mm-hmm. which many of the covert Shin Buddhists are, they were less of a concern.
I see. Right. So I think we're getting to the end. We still haven't, our listeners, in Chapter 5, you focus on Udohomon teachings and initiation rites and you go into very interesting, quite fascinating detail as to what's exactly involved in those, talking about some of the sacred texts that are used and also what the initiation rites sort of achieve for the initiates. But moving on to our last question, I just wanted to, before we sign off, I wanted to ask what you're working on now or if you have any projects in the works at the moment.
Sure, yeah. Well, one thing I'm working on is Nikon. This is really where my focus is today. And Nikon is a contemplative practice that came out of Shin Buddhism that has also been used for psychotherapeutic purposes.
Mm.
And it really focuses on people getting to look at their lives in a contemplative setting. And they were originally, the connection with secretive Shin is that the founder, these contemplative practices were originally done in secret. But today Nikon is practiced in about 40 hospitals and it's quite widespread in Japan. You know, I hope for those who have a chance and willingness to read the book, I hope one of the things besides secrecy that people learn about is really that, you know, Shin Buddhism is a very, very diverse and rich tradition
mm-hmm.
that's very contested, and we really don't get that from most of the introductory texts, simple introductory texts, of just how rich and diverse Shin Buddhism actually is.
Right.
And Nikon is one aspect of that richness. Yeah.
Right. Well, we'll look forward to seeing some your next book on that.
Thank you.
And thanks very much for speaking with me today. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. And that's it for today's New Books in Buddhist Studies. See you next time.